I'd actually like to start tonight doing something a little bit different. I want to take a minute, and just a minute, I want you to just turn to somebody that you are sitting near, but that maybe you haven't talked to before, and just introduce yourself. And you might want to give a little bit of information about if you've been coming to this group for a while, if you belong to other sanghas, maybe how long you've been practicing. But I want you just to get a little bit of a sense of maybe meeting somebody here you haven't met before. So let's just take a minute and please say hi to somebody. Great. I'm sorry to cut it short, but I just wanted to get a little bit of a taste of this for everybody, just to maybe get a sense of who they're sitting by, people you might not have met before. There's a story in the suttas. Lord Buddha's long-time personal attendant and assistant and monk disciple, Ananda, asked the Buddha, "Lord, is it true what has been said, that good spiritual friends are fully half of the holy life?" The Buddha replied, "No, Ananda, good spiritual friends are the whole of the holy life. Find refuge in the Sangha community." For a number of years, I've been taking part with a number of friends of mine in a group that we meet regularly. We meet once a month. And the purpose of our meeting together is to really sort of help guide, to help with the day-to-day or the business issues of the Sangha, and to try to address the needs of the Sangha. We've been meeting, I think this has been going on for years, and the people that come to these meetings has changed from time to time, continues to change. But one focus of these meetings has often been, and continues to be, how do we address the needs of the community? And one thing we've been hearing a lot is people have a desire for community. A lot of people here have been expressing a desire for a sense of community. We had a meeting a few weeks ago, and that day Eugene had asked me to fill in for him that night, and I really didn't know what to talk about. But after that meeting, it just became really clear to me I wanted to talk about Sangha. And it's been a really interesting exploration for me just to take on this topic and to see what this means for me, to see how Sangha plays in my life, to see how community plays in my life, to see how good spiritual friends play in my life. And I want to share some of that. It's also been sort of interesting that one thing I like to do when I decide I'm giving a talk or what I'm going to speak on is to listen to what other people have said about it, just to get a sense of, you know, directions or information on it even. It's a little bit of a fact-finding mission or whatever. And, you know, there are tons of Dharma talks on the web these days, thousands of them. And I went through lots of them. I couldn't find a talk on Sangha. I found some on the three refuges, which I'll talk a little bit about later, but nothing really just specifically on Sangha, which scared me a bit. It was like, oh, maybe we aren't supposed to talk about this, or maybe it's too difficult to talk about. I don't know, but I'm not plagiarizing much tonight anyway. But it's been interesting. I want to share some stuff with you, and part of what I want to share is the traditional model of Sangha in this practice that we share, and also a more contemporary view of it, how Sangha is now pretty much handled or held in the West. And then at the end, I just sort of want to broaden it out and talk about, you know, our good spiritual friends, which basically our community can be as vast as we can imagine it, basically. Our community of mankind, our community of life on this planet. How do we include that? But to start with, I want to get into the more traditional views and teachings around Sangha. Sangha is a Sanskrit word, and it means spiritual community. And I'm sure everybody here has heard this term used. This is how we describe the group that meets here on Sunday night. We're a Sangha of the Insight Meditation Community of San Francisco. The people that go to Spirit Rock call that community a Sangha. One thing I did when I rang the three bells at the end of the sit was I mentioned the reference, the traditional reference to the ringing of the bell three times. And it's acknowledgement of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the three jewels of this practice, the foundation of this practice, the three pillars that hold this practice. Some of you might not have heard this. It was pretty loud in here, and I don't know how loud I was, but since I took this on as a topic to speak about, I've been very conscious of when I hear the bell rung three times, that the last one, it's for Sangha, it's for community. And it reminds me of that. I'm sure many of you have been on retreat or have been in a variety of situations where you take refuge in the three jewels, in the three gems of this practice. And part of the ringing of the bell three times is I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. Often when you go on a retreat or if you're in a monastic situation, this is done every day. It's done every morning in chanting. It's done at the end of the day. It's done often. Just a reminder of where do we go to take refuge. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that so we can get into the taking refuge in the Sangha, in the community. Taking refuge is really about where do we go for safety? What can we rely on? What's reliable? And when you think about it, where do we often go for refuge? We might rely on our career, on our work. I've been reading in the paper this week a lot about the auto parts workers in Flint, Michigan, that worked for Delphi, the largest auto part manufacturer in the country. And there were thousands of people that, you know, had a nice secure union job with a really nice pension plan that now are being told half of them are going to be laid off, no pension plan, and the ones that are left are going to be paid half as much as they were before. There's not much to rely on there. I think we can often also go, think we can rely on relationships, family. But it doesn't take much reflection to see that, you know, that changes too. Our health, you know, I'm healthy, I can rely on that for a while. Bang! Something happens. So where do we go for this refuge? I want to read a little bit from the Dhammapada, one of the oldest and most read of the Buddhist texts. People threatened by fear go to many refuges, to mountains, forest, parks, trees, and shrines. None of these is a secure refuge. None is a supreme refuge. Not by going to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. But when someone going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha sees with right insight the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the arising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering, and the Eightfold Path, leading to the ending of suffering, then this is the secure refuge. This is the supreme refuge. By going to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. Happy is the arising of Buddhas. Happy is the teaching of the true Dharma. Happy is the harmony of the Sangha. Happy is the harmony of the Sangha. I love that. And it's not always there either. Traditionally, and I believe when the Buddha originally talked about taking refuge in the Sangha, he was talking very specifically about the monastic order. The people that would ordain as monks and nuns, the people that would renunciate their lives as they know, you know, their lives as lay people, their lives as family people, their lives as wage earners, and become monastics. This is the original context of Sangha. Very specific. And it had a very specific look to it, and it still does. Sangha in this monastic fashion is practiced today, as far as I can tell, in many ways, just like it was 2,500 years ago when the Buddha first started teaching this practice. The monks and nuns that ordain shave their heads, wear robes. And the shaving of the head is a little bit different than I realized in why I shave my head. Mine's a little bit of, you know, there's vanity involved. I don't want my gray growing in too much. And it's a little bit fashionable. But for the monks, it's a whole, and the nuns, it's a very different thing. It's to take away the sense of selfing that arises with fashion, with look, with identity, with hairdos even. It's to really become connected to this practice in a very alive and visible way. So they symbolize this to us that, you know, there can be freedom that's not tied into identity, that's not tied into fashion, that's not tied into monetary goods. Because when you ordain, you don't handle money. You don't barter for people for goods. Everything is given to you. You live in this economy of gifts, which I want to talk about some more later also. Depending on what monastic order you ordain in, you ordain with many precepts. To the point where I believe there's some monastic orders that have hundreds of precepts. I think, weren't there some that had like 382 precepts that you followed that really are about restraint, about being very careful about this life of non-harming? It's a very particular and very true type of Sangha that existed with the Buddha and that exists today. I think it's really important to recognize that, to recognize that level of Sangha. Which was probably the Sangha that the Buddha was talking about. But I'd like to broaden that out a bit. Now, before I do, I was reading a little bit of this monk, Thanissara Bhikkhu, who has actually spoken here before. He's a monk that has a monastery down in Southern California, lives a monastic life, and really believes that the Sangha in the three jewels that the Buddha's talking about is the monastic order. But it's not just the monastic order. He talks about two types of Sangha. One's the ideal Sangha, and one's the conventional Sangha. The ideal Sangha, as he describes it, are those people, lay or ordained, who have practiced the Dharma to the point of gaining at least a glimpse of the deathless. So he's pointing to a Sangha that includes people that have practiced with enough seriousness that they've gotten some level of experience, some level of wisdom, knowledge through experience, that they've gotten a glimpse of the deathless. And then he talks about the conventional Sangha, that being those of ordained monks and nuns. And they aren't exclusive to one another. There could be monks and nuns that might not have really had that experience, had that glimpse yet. And there can be lay people, people that haven't ordained, that maybe have had some glimpse of that. So it's a little bit broader sense of what the Sangha can entail. The way I see it, sort of my interpretation of it, the Sangha could continue to broaden out from that. Because the way the monastics can live in this culture, in the culture throughout history, is that they live through the generosity of the community around them. They live in this economy of gifts. It's a beautiful system that operated great for the Buddha and operates beautifully today and situations all over the place. The monks and the nuns create the monastic environment without money, without food, without health care, without medicine, and the people that live in the community provide them with this fully. And it's a very give and take relationship. They feed each other beautifully. The monks, by their sincerity of their practice, by the depth of their practice, by the dedication to the practice, provide teachings freely to those communities that they survive in. They provide a living example of the Dharma. A living example of it. It's alive, you know. The community, in turn, get to practice generosity. And it's often said in this practice that the best way to start this practice, the way this practice is taught in Asia, is through the practice of generosity. And you practice the practice of generosity for a long period of time, even before you really start to come into the practice of meditation, of concentration, of mindfulness. You really start with this practice of generosity. That's what the monasteries offer to these communities, this opportunity to really practice this selfless generosity. And traditionally, where these monasteries have existed, are very poor communities. These people don't have a lot traditionally. I know there are people in this room that have practiced in Thailand and in Burma. And it's amazing. Us from the West, we can go and practice in Burma and practice in a monastery, you know, and have a car and a house and a bank account and a retirement fund and home. And yet when we're practicing there, we're being fed freely by people that live, you know, in one-room houses next door with dirt floors. And they will gladly come and feed you every day. It's a pretty amazing experience. What the community also offers the monastics is this continued connection. So the monastics aren't just practicing in an environment that is a little bit closed off. They're in contact with communities. They're in contact with the human condition in another form. When you go out on your alms round in the morning to accept the food, you come in contact with sickness, old age, and death. You come in contact with people that are thriving, with people that aren't thriving. You're reminded of this human world that we're all part of. And that's something that the lay people, the community, the Sangha, what I'm calling Sangha, around the monastics, offer the monastics. While the monastics offer this full-time Dharma experience to the Sangha, the community around them. It's a beautiful system. A good friend of mine just took a month off and went to work for a monastery in England during their three-month rain retreat. In the Thai tradition, and I believe in many traditions, they have long rain retreats, and these monasteries in England are in the Thai tradition. They're in the tradition of Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest tradition. So they go on retreat from January till March, And people come in and cook for them and care for them while they're on retreat. And this friend of mine went and took a month off and went over there and helped cook for them. Mainly for the experience, that experience of the living Dharma, to feel the Dharma as it's truly shown in an alive fashion. But he came back and he talked to me about the senior monk that he was sitting with, Ajahn Sumedho. Ajahn Sumedho is a monk, I believe he's in his 70s now. He went to Thailand in the mid to late 60s and studied with Ajahn Chah, and was the first Western monk that was ordained by Ajahn Chah, and the first Western monk to actually teach Buddhism in Thailand. And in the early 80s, Ajahn Chah, the Thai monk, came with Ajahn Sumedho to England and decided that it would be great if Ajahn Sumedho would start a monastery in England. But one thing Ajahn Chah did was he also made sure that he had the support of a sangha, of a community around him. So he sent, what I was told was a friend of his, Ajahn Chah sent this friend of his to England also, this Thai woman, to really sort of help build this community, this sangha support. This woman's still doing it. And the sangha support now for these monasteries in England is huge. He showed me pictures of the monasteries in England. I've never been there, but it's great. These old English manors that are now these Thai Buddhist monasteries that are totally supported by the community around them. So there's the monastic tradition. There's the monastic sangha. There's the community that supports the monastic tradition, the community, the sangha that supports them. Where we are here in the Bay Area, there are other examples of how this works in not quite the traditional monastic tradition. There's a sangha down in Redwood City, the Insight Community of the Mid Peninsula, I believe it's called, or I don't know the true name of it, but Gil Fronsdahl is the main teacher, and he's not a monk. He's been a monk, but he's not a monk at this time. But they own a building down there. They offer classes, I believe, every day of the week. They have retreats, and it's all offered freely. There's no cost for any of this. If you go down there and take a class, it's free. If you go down there and take a retreat, it's free. And you give what you feel moved to give. You give what comes out of your heart. And it's thriving down there. And it's beautiful to see that. And it builds a certain type of community, a certain type of sangha around that. Which isn't quite the monastic model, but functions in much the same way the monastic model does. So again, it's a little bit broadening out of the scope of what constitutes, what makes up a sangha. This community here has been going on for 12 years now. It started out in a living room with, 15, 20 people. 12 people, I don't know. And it's grown. The community's grown, the numbers have grown. The sense of community has grown sometimes. We were fortunate enough to have a sister sangha in South Africa. I think many of you here are new and you might not know about this, but for a number of years, we had a sangha that we considered our sister sangha in South Africa. And around this community in South Africa, where there were a number of Western teachers working in an area that was devastated by AIDS, by poverty, by people orphaned from AIDS, we helped support that community. First by just donating money, and then for the next couple of years we raised money through doing different fundraising events. Large events where we auctioned off goods. We had talent show, we had a raffle, we did all kinds of things. And what happened around this particular kind of service, this particular service of generosity, was there was a real building of community around this. There was a greater sense of sangha than I had felt here before around this type of service, around this type of generosity of giving. I see that spirit still going on in this group. I come in tonight, and my cushion is just set up here. You know, the altar's set up. There are flowers on the altar. The chairs are set up. You know, the tea is out. People are giving of themselves to see that the community continues, to see that the community is taken care of, to see that there is an opportunity for us to practice together and to hear the teachings together. There are people that bring up the cushions and take down the cushions to make sure that the newsletter gets printed, that the articles are out there. There are tremendous acts of generosity that go on within our own community. There's also been concern around how do we charge for these teachings sometimes. It's a difficult issue, especially when we don't have our own building. I just want to acknowledge that because it's something I grapple with a lot. I've been teaching beginning meditation here for a while. We offer a base fee of $35, which goes to pay for the rent of the church. But the more I really studied what the tradition of this community-based practice that we do together comes from, it would be beautiful to offer it for free. And that is when the practice is alive in a little bit different flavor. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about the benefits of Sangha practice. This practice that we do together. This is a practice we don't do alone. We need teachers. We need people to help teach us. We need friends along this path. We need the opportunity to come in contact with the teachings. We don't do this alone. It's funny, sometimes when you go on retreat, I first heard about this practice from a therapist I had a number of years ago, some 12, 15 years ago, and she encouraged me to go on retreat. And she said one of the real beauties of going on retreat is that you don't have to, you get to be free of the stress of relating to other people. And there's a real beauty to that. When you go and practice on a day-long or on a week-long or on a month-long retreat, that stress of relating goes away. What am I going to say? What if I don't like what they say? Even the small stress of being with people that we like and enjoy being with, it just falls away. But I think that there can be a trap almost sometimes of thinking that this practice is sort of an isolated practice. No, we do it together. You can also feel the energy that comes from when we all come in here and sit together, the support that comes with that. I think we live in a time and a place where individualism is very predominant. I can even think of, you know, about cell phones. We can the variety of cell phones and what this says about who you are and your own identity. There's a whole, you know, unfathomable scope of ways that we can sort of say this is who I am and this is my individuality. How we dress, how we act, where we go. It even comes into our practice. We are very fortunate to live in this time and place where there are more opportunities and schools of practice than have probably ever existed in Buddhism before. I think it's pretty safe to say that. In the Bay Area right now, there's a greater variety and opportunity to practice than has ever been available before. I think along with that, though, sometimes comes a little bit of disconnect and the possibility of not having the experience of Sangha because we can pick and choose so much and we don't have to really stay put. Traditionally, I think when people practiced, there was pretty much one center where you practiced, or a few, or pretty much one style. That became your Sangha. Sort of no questions asked. Here we can just sort of move around and say, I'll take a little bit of that, a little bit of that. Even among senior practitioners that I know, there can be a real tendency to follow the latest teacher, the latest teaching. Sort of where do we settle? Where do we really develop this sense of community, the people that we practice together with? It's something to think about, to consider. Because part of the beauty of practicing together in a group is that we start to lose, there's the opportunity to lose a bit of our sense of isolation and a little bit of a sense of this dualism, me and you, us and them. The opportunity to practice more in the realm of us, the non-dual. I was walking through the Castro today getting a burrito with my partner, and I passed a wall of there's a whole lot of posters, mainly posters for movies and new record albums. But in the midst of these posters was this poster that read, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. It was a Margaret Mead quote. And I thought, you know, that's really beautiful. It's really one of the benefits of practice together. That our practice as single individuals has a certain power to it. But our practice as a community, it's amped up a bit. When we practice as a community together here with the Sister Sangha to raise money for South Africa, I think over the course of 3 or 4 years, we must have raised $35,000, $40,000 more. And we build a building there, which now is used for education, for housing, for schooling, for and that's what we did as a community. And it's you know, a living, breathing example of what you can do as a community together. One of the benefits of the Sangha practice. When we finish our sits here, we dedicate the merit, and we dedicate it to the benefit of all beings. And it's something I realized a long time ago. The practice we do here together is for the benefit of all beings. Us connecting with some sort of sense of truth, with us connecting with the ability to respond appropriately, with us trying to connect with some sort of wisdom and compassion, it just inherently is for the benefit of all beings. It just naturally is. If I'm calmer and more peaceful and more compassionate, that is a benefit for everybody I come in contact with. It just radiates out. If we can do that as a community, if that can be seen as being done as a community, it can be a beautiful thing. We do practice for the benefit of all. There are difficulties of practicing in community also. And that's something else. As soon as I took this on as a topic, I realized that Sangha practice is not easy sometimes. I don't know if you've noticed, but sometimes people can be petty, ignorant. They can talk too much. They cannot focus too well. They can be argumentative. And it makes it difficult to be in relationship with that sometimes. It's not easy. But part of the realization comes in, too, is that when we sit in the cushion and pay attention to ourselves, I don't know about you, but I find I can be petty, I can be ignorant, I can be difficult, I can be argumentative. It's the skills we learn to deal with that, the skills of patience, the skills of compassion, the skills of forgiveness. It's what we learn, I think, a lot when we sit in silence and just pay attention to our own experience. But it's also the practice of Sangha. Can we learn that in relationship to other people? I'm on a number of committees right now, and there's sometimes that the difficulty gets to the point where it's like, fine, I've had enough. I don't have to deal with this. I'm pulling away. And maybe sometimes that'll be a wise thing to do. But the other thing is, can I bring this practice of understanding, of appropriate response, of forgiveness, of patience, to my Sangha practice, to my practice in community? So that the practice I practice here becomes a lived practice in relationship. It's an interesting thing to play with. Because a lot of what I found when I took this on as a topic is that I have a real tendency to pull away sometimes. Just like, okay, this is enough. I don't have to deal with this, you know. I'm beyond this. It's like, that feeling of wanting to pull away, of pulling away from community, which I think is a lot of where we find ourselves as a culture right now. People don't want to get involved. People don't want to commit themselves. People have difficulty in community. I want to broaden the scope of community even a little bit farther, because one thing I was thinking about, again, while I'm taking on this topic is, you know, who is my community? This is certainly something I consider part of my Sangha. And it's something I value a lot. Something I try to give back to from time to time. But I mentioned to some friends, when I was thinking about Sangha, I'd be finding myself riding my bike down the street, and I'd just look at people on the sidewalk and saying, you know, are you part of my Sangha? Are you part of my Sangha? And I realized at some point you have to let everybody in. Or maybe it's wise to let everybody in. Or, you know, maybe there's some benefit to letting everybody into your Sangha. Again, really broadening this out. And it's really interesting because in doing that, I felt a much greater sense of connection with all kinds of people. You know, the young woman talking on her cell phone, driving her SUV that almost cut me off. Part of my Sangha, you know. The guy that's living on the street corner down at 6th and Market on my bike ride that's, you know, screaming at the people that ride by. Yeah, he's part of my Sangha, part of my community. That's going to the really broad sense of it, though. Currently, I'm working on a documentary on firemen. And I want to come back to this sense of spiritual community, because when I've been listening to these firemen tell their stories and tell about their lives and their connection with being firemen, firewomen, it's been really interesting, because to me, they have a really strong sense of spiritual community in the workplace. And I'm sure most of them that I've heard would not call it such, but to me, it just reeks of it. Because they're totally dependent on one another. When they go into a fire, you're dependent on the guy in front of you and the guy behind you. And you trust in that, and you just let go into that. If you're the first guy in the house, you trust that the guy at the water has turned the water on. If you get the guy cutting the hole in the roof so the guy in the water can spray and the heat can leave, you trust that the guy's in there with the water so that the hole in the roof doesn't all of a sudden just cause the fire to go berserk and burn up the guy inside. There's all this give and play and trust that is just inherent in their community together. Their whole goal, their whole sense of purpose is around helping people. And that just reeks of from all the stories I've heard of all these firemen tell and this doc I'm working on. And it's really beautiful. They're there to help people. What a sense of spiritual community. And I bring that up now too, just so that we, you know, where are our spiritual communities? You know, for each of us. In the home, in the family, in the workplace, in the neighborhood. I had a meeting at my house this week, and somebody from the group came up and said, you know, you live in a great neighborhood. And it made me reflect for a moment about how much I do enjoy my neighborhood. And I love my neighborhood. And one of the reasons I love my neighborhood was because of this guy who used to live next door to me, who introduced all the neighbors to each other. And he introduced everybody. You know, it didn't matter age, didn't matter race, didn't matter sexual preference, which in the Castro has a little bit of relevance sometimes. You know, you're like, oh, too many straight people moving in. But he would introduce everybody, and he had a sense of community that emanated out, and I know a lot of my neighbors because of this person. And he passed away from lung cancer last Labor Day at 42 years old. And this friend here tonight said, you know, did he have hospice care? And it was like, he didn't need hospice care because his sense of community was such that he was totally taken care of 24 hours a day for the last couple of months of his life. And it was beautiful to see. It was family, it was friends, it was neighbors. They just took care of him. So this sense of community, you know, it feeds back on us. How, you know, he had such a sense of what I would call spiritual community from being in a neighborhood that it came back and took care of him as he was dying. It was beautiful to see. So that's just to, you know, go into the really broad sense of Sangha. But to come back into this community we share here together, that I hope you maybe got a little bit of sense of just when you talked to a neighbor tonight, or when you took a break, or that you know maybe you've had before, or a lot of before. In this group that I'm with, that as we try to plan, you know, how do we create more community opportunities here for us as a group, as the Sangha? One thing I've realized is that in the past, it happens because people in the Sangha have taken on that responsibility. The Sister Sangha events happened because people in the community took it on. We're going to raise money and we're going to do it this way. And we need help, so come help us. The day-to-day, the evening functions that happen because people come in and volunteer. Somebody came up and asked Eugene and I last week if we're doing any more. We used to do bike rides here, these little Buddhist bike rides called them Byatras, meditative bike rides. And they were really sort of sweet, and about 20 or 30 of us would go on bike rides. They never seemed very meditative to me because we yapped the whole time. And Eugene did most of the yapping, actually. But we'd go someplace for lunch, and it developed a sense of community. But it happened because a woman in the group said, I want to organize this. I want to do this. I want to see this happen. She left. They stopped. I bring this up now because I actually really want to encourage people. Community happens when we get involved. So to develop a greater sense of community here, you might consider, you know, what would I like to see happen here? How can it happen? And, you know, maybe can I pull it off? I think you'd be surprised what happens. The Sister Sangha events were amazing. And they happened just because people in the group said, okay, we're taking this on. We had a couple of hundred people in these two rooms. And a beautiful event. So think about it. What do you want to see us do as a community? How can we get involved? How can we really take part in one of the jewels of this practice? A couple of things I'd like to say in closing. I had heard a long time ago that Thich Nhat Hanh had said that I don't understand a lot about this, but in Buddhism there's been a lot of talk about another Buddha's coming. It's a bit like, I hope it's not like the what the Christians talk about sometimes, where a lot of people are going to burn up and all the good people go off someplace else. I digress. But Thich Nhat Hanh talks about the second, another coming, or the next coming of the Buddha. And he talks about that coming of the Buddha being that Buddha being Sangha, not an individual, but Sangha as the next coming of the Buddha. And I didn't really understand when I first heard that what he meant by that. But in thinking about it and trying to find more to read about that, I realized that he's really talking about a council of beings, a council of Sangha members, a council of monks, a council of spiritual teachers that really exemplify the coming of the next Buddha, or that are the next Buddha. So maybe we're already experiencing it. Maybe it's Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama, you know, and Ajahn Chah that just was here. Who knows? I don't know. But it's an interesting thing to think about, that this next depth of our practice is really going to come from Sangha, from community, from spiritual friends. Ananda asked, Lord, is it true what has been said that good spiritual friends are fully half of the holy life? The master replied, No, Ananda, good spiritual friends are the whole of the holy life. Find refuge in the Sangha community.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.